This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Heartland Institute's Daily Podcast. I'm Sterling Burnett, Director of the Arthur B. Robinson Center on Climate and Environmental Policy and Managing Editor of Environment and Climate News. I'm pleased to have as a guest today, young climate researcher whose career trajectory has been on a wild ride for the past year, Matthew Wilecki, PhD. I've had the pleasure to speak with Matt before when he was a guest on Heartland's weekly Climate Change Roundtable live stream. He was, until recently, an assistant professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Alabama and a postdoctoral research scientist at the Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences and the Institute for Planets and Extraplanets at the University of California, Los Angeles. Now he refers to himself as an Earth Science Professor in Exile. How he attained that lofty title is part of what we'll be speaking about today. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sterling. Thanks for having me.
So I know you left before I asked my normal first question, but I'm a little curious. So you left the University of Alabama, but are you still with the Department of Earth, Planetary, and Space Sciences?
No. So right now I don't have any affiliations with either. I still have a PhD student that's going through finishing up his PhD. So I'm just kind of an outside committee member that doesn't really carry an affiliation. So I'm not affiliated with any of those academic institutions, although there's some discussion about possibly joining an academic institution such that I can, I guess carry a little bit more weight in the community. And, there is definitely a real quick rejection of someone that's not in the academic field, even though they were, if they've kind of left, There's a good subset of people that basically just reject you. So maybe keeping that an affiliation would hopefully allow me to reach more people. But at the moment, I am not affiliated with any academic institutions.
Yeah, get some adjunct position. There are some, you've got some allies up there in Colorado, I think. I think of Roger Pelkey Jr., but
sure.
There's good universities and colleges, Hillsdale and stuff, who are a little bit more open-minded. Whether you could do a live remote or a semester on, semester off, I don't know.
Yeah.
Before we jump into your current work, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you, may not have heard our live stream before, please give us a little bit of your background, your previous work, and how you came to work in the field of climate science and why you are now, as you say, an earth science professor in exile.
I have a background in my original degree is actually biochemistry and cellular biology. Right around during the time when the human genome was being decoded, and I really thought that was going to be the future and we were going to cure every cancer and everything like that. And so I was always a scientist and had a very analytical science mind. That unfortunately didn't happen. And I found myself kind of always looking outside the window in the lab and thinking about how I can merge my love for the outdoors with a scientific background. And so I ended up in earth science. It seemed like this natural merger of kind of someone that's an outdoorsy person, but also has a kind of scientific mind. And so I ended up getting a PhD in geochemistry from UCLA. And then I went on and became a faculty member at the University of Alabama. My primary interests were in geochronology and in trying to understand the time scales of processes. And so I worked with a lot of folks in the climate field. When I was coming into the field, there was really no climate science. I mean, everybody that was in climate science was either considered an atmospheric physicist or a earth scientist. You were either looking at how the physical climate works today, which is really the physics of the atmosphere, or you were thinking about how the past climate worked. And that was essentially a geologist, an earth scientist, because much of the information is in the rocks. And so I kind of stayed out of the field, but was just kind of tangentially related by being someone that's a geochronologist, meaning I would provide them the timing of the layers that they were looking at. I could give you the precise date by looking at certain radiogenic isotopes about the timing of whatever rock layer you were looking at. And so I took this position at the University of Alabama, and I started to realize very quickly, especially after I had kids, that there was something going on in terms of the mental health aspect of how we were conveying information about the state of the planet and the environment. And I just started to become more and more vocal. I realized that my funding wasn't dependent on it, because I didn't, you know, I wasn't producing climate research per se. I wasn't, you know, lead author on papers that were making statements about climate, but I was using all the same techniques. These are the isotopic ratios and big mass spectrometers, and I understood the natural variability and the inherent uncertainties that come with using these big instruments. And so I was a little bit cautious about the certainty of the threat. And then I really started to kind of change my views after I had kids, and especially during COVID, when I just realized that there was a huge mental toll that this whole kind of, you know, catastrophizing of the planet, this idea that we're somehow destroying the planet, the mental health aspect on young people is enormous. And I guess I never really thought about it before I had children. And so I started to become more and more vocal, and that is unacceptable in the academic community at the time. I was also vocal about other aspects of just judging people with, you know, no regard to the amount of melanin in their skin. And these things are just weren't acceptable. And so I decided I was going to leave. I'm sure I wouldn't have probably got tenure if I stayed, but we decided we would leave. And so that's why I take the title now of Earth Science Professor in Exile.
Well, now, you decided to leave. Was the parting from the university amicable, at least? I've been a visiting scholar at university since I got my PhD. I've taught lectures, but not being affiliated, I don't know if you get some kind of severance or, you know, what goes on there.
Yeah, there's no. I mean, it was amicable on my end. I realized that I didn't really fit into academia at the time. We, you know, thankfully, my wife and I have a lot of support from our family, and we've made some good investments. And so, you know, financially, this wasn't
okay.
Yeah, well, this wasn't, you know, but I totally understand the self-preservation instinct, and a lot of the folks that I was in. Maybe not my department. Well, some in my department, but I don't. You know, many of my colleagues and all over, you know, told me that they would love to do the same thing, but they just don't have that option. They would love to speak out like I have, but it was clear that if you spoke out, that even if you wanted to have an amicable break and it was okay, and I have no animosity against the University of Alabama or any of my colleagues, the university came and told the faculty that they should just completely. Stay away from me. So, you know, don't communicate with this faculty member. There was other faculty members in the university, not in my department, thankfully, that were comparing me to, you know, racists and you know, all sorts of folks, and telling and claiming that I'm a danger to the students and to the faculty.
Wow.
So it was clear that if you made these kinds of statements, or if you disagreed with this narrative, and I never made bold statements. I just started to make, you know, ask questions and start
questions.
Ask them publicly.
You did what scientists are supposed to do.
Yeah. I thought that's how we get closer to the truth, as we discuss, and, you know, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of these questions were stupid, and I'm more than willing to be shot down. But the fact that just asking these questions alone was enough to stir all this controversy and have the university essentially backtracking, it showed me that there was no chance for someone that wanted to stay in the university to do this. And so I have, you know, the utmost respect and understanding for my colleagues that maybe agree with me but don't speak out, because the environment is absolutely toxic right now for anybody that disagrees with the narrative, particularly with a few of these issues, climate and DEI, diversity being two of them.
Yeah. So you left the university. I think before when we spoke, you mentioned you were still monitoring or on the committees of some students that I guess the university allowed you to stay on that in that role. What, if anything, do you miss about being out of the university?
Oh, I miss a ton of it. I mean, I grew up on a college campus. My father was a faculty member. My mother was on staff at Cal State University Fresno, and so I just loved it. I there's just the way that it used to be that the students have this just thirst. You know, it's not high school where you're getting force fed these materials because you have to go through it. This is now, I'm interested in this and I'm choosing these topics because I'm interested. And, you know, of course you got students in the back, they're just sleeping and snoring and whatever, but there's just so many young people that were thirsty for information and that, just that young, you know, vigor that the world is my oyster. There's just so much possibility. I just found it so, like, I just loved it. I loved my interactions with the students. You know, that was probably my favorite part. The research part is also awesome. The rest of it, which is basically begging for money and jumping through hoops and checking through boxes because the funding agencies are now completely captured ideologically. I have to make a statement in my proposal about how me figuring out what age of some impact crater is, how that has a broader impact on minority students in geoscience. And, you know, so.
Because rocks are racist.
Yeah, right. And so, I definitely miss this. I miss the students. I miss the research. You know, the politics, the best year was my last year when I told the chair already knew I was leaving. So I said, hey, at the beginning of the semester, I said, hey, you know, you guys don't need me at the faculty meetings, right? Because, you know, you're making long-term decisions. We've already told the faculty that I'm leaving. And so she's like, yeah, you don't have to be there. I was like, oh, thank God. So last year was my favorite year because I could just focus on like getting my students through and focus on teaching and not deal with any of the politics.
There you go. So, what have you been doing since then? I know you've been writing a lot. I personally know that. But so what's going on in your life?
How's
your research proceeded?
Yeah, so I write a lot. I've been doing just a little bit of, you know, kind of my own figure, making some of my own figures and downloading some of the data sets that people are making publicly available just to show folks that, you know, you can do a lot with data. You can make data look essentially any way you want it to look. And so, you know, it's essentially just writing on Substack and trying to offer a different perspective. You know, we've always been dabbling in the rental business. And so we do a little bit of that. I'm looking into maybe purchasing a business. And so I've always wanted to do, I've been in academia my whole life. So has my family. So we've always wanted, my father's a business professor for his whole life. So we've always talked about purchasing a business or starting a business of our own. And so, you know, I'm excited for just kind of a new aspect, but I'm in the climate documentary that's coming out soon. I still want to be discussing about climate.
Who's producing that documentary?
That's Martin Durkin, I believe.
Oh, okay. The English.
That's right. Who did
the great climate. I want to say climate hoax. But I don't think that's right.
No, it's
climate scandal or.
No. Yeah, I forget what. Yes.
Yeah, no. I remember. He brilliant documentary. So you're going to be in that. Let me ask you this. Have you reached out to any of your peers who are also sort of either have left or on the fringes of academia? So I know a friend of mine, David LeGates, of course, works with the Cornwall Alliance. Willie Soon works with Ceres and a big group of scientists there. And then there's Clintel. Have you looked into working with them and doing some academic publishing with them?
You know, I mean, we've discussed it a little bit. We've discussed it. I've discussed it with Clintel. I've discussed it with CO2 Coalition and a few other groups. The truth is that it's so toxic, the debate right now, that I feel that I will probably have more breakthrough staying independent.
I see.
Because just being affiliated with some of these groups, even though I think they're just doing normal work and they're doing essentially the same stuff I do, it gets you thrown out by so many of particularly young people, which is the group that I would like to break through with. So there's been some discussions. I'm still hesitant at the moment. I just don't see publishing in the peer-reviewed literature as being nearly as valuable anymore as I thought it was. My academic advisor for my PhD is a National Academy of Sciences member, and you know, top papers have something like 10,000 review, you know, citations, and I feel like I could have such a much bigger impact, and all of the science already exists. We don't need to add to the science. If anything, we're data overloaded, but people aren't interpreting the data correctly because there's just a narrative that exists where whatever data comes in, it's fit through this lens.
Yeah.
And so it all conforms to this one belief. And I don't know if we need to go publish more data. I think we just need new interpretations. And the truth is the public doesn't go and read scientific journals.
No.
Right? They read people's interpretations of those journals and the media's interpretation of those journals. And so I feel like there may be more value in doing it this way, which is through just basically through a subscription form or just, you know, writing opinion pieces in major publications and things like that. This is essentially what Wright Roger does. Roger's now leaving the University of Colorado Boulder. He put in for his retirement. But people like Bjorn Lomborg and things like that. I think you can have, although both of them still publish in the peer-reviewed literature, because I understand the value of it, but it's so ugly and dirty and gross. I don't really want to deal with it, to tell you the truth, anymore.
I thought of something while you were speaking earlier, but now it's escaped my mind. The hazards of old age, I suspect. Maybe it'll come back to me. Until then, so you started your Substack page. I hope it's doing well. You've written many articles on it, and there are some that I found especially interesting. The first one is called Manufacturing Consensus. What's that one about?
Yeah, so, you know, you can essentially hide how you get to consensus. Consensus is just this weird term that we're all now talking about for some reason, which doesn't really make sense to me. This is something that we've known in the past has led us astray, and yet we're back to doing this type of, you know, this type of science where we don't want to discuss the actual science. We want to discuss whether or not scientists agree on a certain topic. And that's not nearly as important as discussing the topic. And so I wrote that piece, especially after the recent Michael Mann decision, so the defamation case, and that Michael Mann was awarded $1 million, and not in damages that were suffered from, he was awarded $1 in damages, but in terms of punitive costs, this idea that you're punishing someone because they were defaming someone with malice, but even though the person suffered no damage, right? We can't attack climate scientists. We can't question climate scientists. We can't question their statistics and the way that they manipulate data or the way that they pick certain ensembles of models as opposed to others. We're not allowed to do that. And if you do this and now you litigate it and now people are literally losing money, I think nobody in the actual judicial community thinks that the $1 million punitive damage will stand. That's a million to one, I think, and so that's that's crazy. I think 1,000 to 1 is much more comparable.
According to the Supreme Court, I think more than 100 to 1 is highly unusual and not to be recommended.
Oh, it's even 100 to 1. Okay, I thought it was the Supreme Court case at 1,000 to 1. But it's this whole idea that you can silence every dissenting voice, not because you want to discuss the science, but because you can sue them, you call them deniers, you find any sort of mistake that they've made in terms of something that they've posted or something like that. And I've done plenty. You know, you try to just discredit people before you ever want to actually engage. And it's just a very strange, and it's really one side of the argument. I see it very little on the side that's saying like, hey, maybe we should have a little bit more discussion about natural variability or what our expected outcomes of lowering CO2 emissions should have given all of this history in the geologic record. They would essentially just try to silence you. And this is why it's almost like a religion, right? You're a heretic. Yeah. And so you manufacture a consensus. You sue people, you silence them, you kick them out of the IPCC. And then what do you say? Oh, look, 90-something% of us agree.
Lawfare and ostracism creates consensus.
Yeah, right.
As if consensus, it's funny. There was an article published last year that says consensus, that literally said consensus is the goal of science. It's like, no, knowledge is the goal of science.
Absolutely.
And consensus is a political concern. And I'm wondering why we even care about consensus in science. But in any case, as you say, it's become the dominant thing. So the second article you wrote that I want to talk about is how the climate alarmist sausage is made. Now, first, I'm sure most of our audience probably knows about the famous quote. But tell us about where the sausage reference and how it's made comes from, and then discuss the article.
So this is regarding a recent report about the AMOC, right? The Atlantic, what is it? I always say multi-decadal, but it's
no,
not.
Meridional.
Yeah, that's right. Oscillation. Yeah. So the sausage essentially is the unscientific exaggeration of threat. That's the sausage. And I think the sausage exists everywhere. The sausage exists in race. There's an unscientific exaggeration of threat in racism. There's an unscientific exaggeration of threat in like trans and LGBTQ people. You know, this is something that is a common tactic in the media and in a way to try to push policy behavior or policy, right? Which is essentially behavioral changes. Yeah, go ahead.
Before we go too far down that road, though, I thought you'd make this point. Maybe I'm. So the sausage, in this case, comes about because it's politics. All these things are not about science. They ceased to largely be about science. I hear scientists tell me all the time, the science is settled. Okay, then you don't need money anymore, because we've already solved your issue. Now let's move on to politics. Oh, no, we got things to know. We got things to discover. They never want to get rid of their money. But the point is, Otto, not Bismarck, it was the guy who brought together Germany, the Iron Chancellor.
That's not Bismarck? That's...
Yeah, it was Bismarck. It was Otto Bismarck who said, if one... love sausage or politics, one should not see how they are made. Something to that effect, and that's what's going on here. They're grinding people up. They get in the way of making the sausage. But in this case, you were talking about a specific issue, the AMOC, Atlantic Meridional Ocean Current, and how they came to certain conclusions that were ludicrous.
Yeah, exactly. And more than that is how that narrative was pushed by the media. So we say it's politics, but it's really the media, the politics driving the media, and then the media amplifying that whole thing. Because politicians saying it, nobody really listens to them, right? But it's the media that really pushes this. And it was all over the news. It was all over the internet. It was constantly being repeated by very high-end climate, you know, scientists, like top-of-the-line folks. You know, I'm blocked by most of them, but I could see a few of them. So I think I included a few posts by some of the European folks. They tend to be a little bit more open and not block. But, you know, these are directors of major programs, you know, things that provide essentially all of the science that we see. A lot of the IPCC reviewers, these were being constantly retweeted. And what it turns out is that this whole hoopla that this current, which really is a very important current, it really does, especially in the North Atlantic, it's moving warm waters from near the equator up along the eastern seaboard of the U.S. and up into the North Atlantic. And that's what really regulates the climate in places like the UK and Europe. They would be much colder without this warm water current that's coming up. And so destabilizing that current is obviously something that we should be concerned about. But what it turns out is that they, you know, this is garbage in, garbage out. They completely unrealistically forced their model by inputting so much fresh water that it's just out of the realm of possibility and forcing it.
It was, they put in 5 times more fresh water than is contained in the Greenland ice cap is how much fresh water they put in there.
It's ridiculous.
It was impossible. Right? It was an impossible amount of water. And when was the tipping point? About 1,700 years in the future.
That's right. That's right. So they don't talk about the time that it took after they enormously forced their model. Mm-hmm. They just say it's at the edge of tipping. You know, and that's the headlines and things like that. And that's what drives policy. And these guys are the ones that are publishing these white papers and driving a lot of these agendas. And none of them, at least so I, you know, I've asked a couple times on social media if anybody has actually come out and corrected it, you know, let me know. And I haven't seen anybody actually come out and say, look, there have been other scientists that looked at this paper that we talked about. And it seems as though they unrealistically forced their model. And so this isn't nearly as big of a, you know, and it's just weird because I screw up all the time and I'll come out there and I'll say it like, oh, I got that one wrong. Or I updated this. I screwed this math up. I put the decimal in the wrong place a couple times. You know, it's like, oh, I was only a couple orders of magnitude off. But you just never hear that.
But they don't – I think for this paper, they're not issuing a correction because they don't think one's needed. They know what they did.
Right. They know what they did. I want the correction to come out from
the journal,
from the scientists, from the community that says, hey, you know, the way that this was portrayed in the media and by a lot of these big name scientists when they're tweeting about this that the media is picking up on and using in their coverage – is not really accurate. I wish that the community could have a little bit of spine and self-regulate itself. But ultimately, everybody kind of looks at each other and says, well, you know, that's kind of bullshit what they said. But, you know, that's just going to bring more funding. This is bringing more media coverage. So let's just zip our lips. And plus, if you say anything, you know, we might lose our position.
Yeah, to tell you how it's lingering, just this morning I did a search for the term climate change in news, and that came up in the top 10. Three weeks on, they're still flogging this dead horse, ignoring the fact that dozens of other studies have been published since 2020 alone, some of which say the AMOC is speeding up. Some of them say it's slowing down. There's no consensus. You know, we talk about consensus. There's no consensus about this whatsoever, but it's sure getting a lot of coverage.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part. You know, like everybody just reads the headlines, right?
Yeah. So the third article I wanted to touch on a little bit is one called Rethinking Climate Metrics. What's that about?
So, you know, I complain a lot about essentially just how we portray a very complicated system and try to, which is, you know, just the variability is enormous, right? I think in that article I showed in just a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, there was something like 90 degrees Celsius of variation just within the continent of China, or not continent, the country of China. So just in Southeast Asia, you had something like 90 degrees of variability. And so in a system where that is so highly variable, if you reduce it to a single metric, I don't really know whether that is useful or not. And I tend to lean towards the idea that it's not useful. Nobody really lives in the global average temperature or the global temperature anomaly. So I was really just kind of, I get irked when I see global temperature anomaly and you see these, you know, spiking plots where it looks like it's going up like crazy. And, you know, the idea that, the idea that you can join, first of all, modern measurements with proxy temperatures, which I talk about a lot, the granularity of what we know in the past compared to what we know in the present is very different. And putting these together is, I would argue, unscientific and unethical. But the idea that, I lost my train of thought. The idea that you can take absolute temperature in a system that's very highly variable and then plot it in a way that you can choose a baseline is a little sneaky. It doesn't really, first of all, it doesn't portray useful information in my mind because nobody lives in the global average temperature. So the global average temperature anomaly doesn't really mean anything. But it also just doesn't show you that in the overall absolute temperatures of the system, the climate system that we're talking about, the change is relatively small. It chooses certain baselines, and particularly when you see baselines chosen from like 1850 to 1899, which is essentially the end of the Little Ice Age. It's just lying with statistics in my mind.
Well, it's problematic from a number of different points of view. You know, one of them is the idea that we know what the ideal temperature is, that we have this God's eye point of view, and we know that the temperature 100 years ago was ideal, 150 years ago was ideal before we started pumping CO2 into the atmosphere. Somehow that's the it's just like some environmentalists say, oh, we've lost paradise. If only the world was like what? Well, the 1700s in America, the thousands in America, you know, 1000 when the Vikings came over, pick your time period. It's just, you're making it up. It's your assumption of what the world should be like.
I think it's without a doubt that the 1.1 degrees of warming, if we just accept the absurdity of global mean temperature, has been a net benefit to human civilization. That's just undisputable.
I agree 100%. The other thing that's very odd about the global average temperature. So we know what an average is in a classroom, right? We have students, and there are a limited number of students. They are tested on the same materials. And on testing, standardized testing, whatever you think of it, that standardized testing, they produce grades that we can rank and know that everything was this. You know, we can't know their home life is the same. We can't know their intellectual acuity is the same. But we can know that the questions were the same, the material covered was the same, and they either captured that material or they didn't. We can't know that all the different temperature readings are the same.
That's right.
the gauges are different. Some of them have been moved. Some of them have been closed. They then meld bad data with good data to homogenize it. But that's like taking bottled water and mixing it in a glass with water from the stream, the gutter, and saying, oh, well, this is average water. And we feel it's high quality.
It's absolutely reductionist, and it takes away from a really beautiful complex system And it's completely done, right, to because we want to regulate one thing, right, a greenhouse gas. And so we'll reduce the whole system down into a global average temperature, and then we'll show that next to a global average CO2, which is ridiculous as well, because if you just in this room right now, I used to take a CO2 monitor into my lecture hall. And by the end of the lecture, you know, we'd be at 800, 900 PPM in the room. You take it into a forest, right, underneath a canopy. And, you know, to think that, you know, so you take two kind of ridiculous reductionist metrics that reduce a really complex system, and because you want to blame this one on this one, and then it makes it simple. But, you know, I kind of reject all of that. And I say, look, we know the benefits of fossil fuels, right? Because we know we can compare first world countries to third world countries, or developed countries to developing countries. Show me the negative of, you know, in the observable data of the current, you know, whatever warming you want to claim, I'll give you whatever number you want. Like, let's not focus on the number so much. Let's just talk about real world observable data. What, let's compare positives, and we know the positives are pretty enormous. Let's compare that to the negatives. And it's clear to me that the positives outweigh the negatives by orders of magnitude.
Yeah. If you can discern the negatives at all.
That's right.
So, Matt, in closing, if there are only a single point you can make, the most important point you'd like our listeners to take away from our discussion today, what would that be? And by the way, how can they learn more about you and read more of your work?
I mean, I guess I'm just someone that wants people to, especially young people, to have hope for their future. There is no reason that, you know, young people shouldn't be worried or considering major life changes about like family structure and things like that because of the state of the environment. The state, the human condition is good. It doesn't mean that there aren't places that we can do better, and there's always going to be places we can do better, and we should always strive to do better. But you know, the outlook for both the environment and the planet is pretty darn good. If there's anything that could really hinder that for them, it's going to be very restrictive policies that are undertaken in the guise of somehow changing the weather or the climate. And I just hope they don't get fooled for that, because I don't think that's going to have any benefit. And the overall result would be that they will lose wealth and they will lose freedom. And I think if they objectively look at the data, there's really no reason to be in some sort of panic. The observable data is pretty clear. The models are something different now. You know, models are untestable, so I can't, you know, put a model into the scientific method, so I can't really discuss models. We can see if the models are right or wrong, but the models have been around for a while, and they've been predicting this stuff for a while, and it's not coming to fruition. And so, you know, I hope that's, you know, just kind of something that people start to realize. Climate's a very convenient tool for governments to get involved in every aspect of your life. And
in one sense, they're right. In one sense, the alarmists are right. Climate changes everything. Climate is everything, right?
It really is.
In one sense.
That's right.
It's but, what you know,
it's what you drive. It's where you work. It's how much you travel. You know, it's everything.
You know, you mentioned that they are losing their wealth and they're losing their freedom, or it threatens to cost people their wealth and freedom. I think it's already costing us some of that. But the most evident thing, and I think this is something that you didn't mention in your closing, but you did mention it the first. The most evident thing that it is the most detrimental impact, not that climate change, but that climate. The climate scare story, the climate narrative, is having the psychological damage it's having on America's, not America's youth, world youth. You know, it's not a coincidence that we have a whole category of psychology now, you know, eco-psychology, where kids are losing hope because they see, you know, they've been told repeatedly that the planet is coming to an end, the world's coming to an end. They've become defeated by the thought, depressed, anxiety-ridden, angst-ridden, and it's that's real harm. And it's not harm from climate change, because they can't see climate change. It's harm from the reporting and the constant barrage of fairy tales they're being fed about climate change.
Yeah, they're the safest generation from any sort of natural disaster than any generation before them, right? Because of technology and because of how we understand weather and things like that. And so that was definitely probably the thing that really irked me the most is, as an earth science community, we should be telling people and making sure that they're confident of the state of the climate and the state of the planet environmentally, and they're not. They have this upside down view, and it's because of, you know, the media, the politicians, and a lot of scientists that refuse to speak up because they just, you know, they see this as a net benefit for them. If people are more, you know, more panicked, then more funding comes to this whole thing.
Yeah, no, it's awful. It reminds me of the South Park episode where climate change happens because someone broke a beaver dam, but you see these people running. Oh my God, it's climate change, and you see this hulking shadow behind them running as they run down the street, like climate change is a physical being about to overcome them.
And you know, it's terrible too, because every time there's now relatively preventable disasters, for example, the amount of rainfall that happens in San Diego every, I don't know, 30 years or something. Now you just throw up your hands if you're a politician and say, look, CO2, what can we do? You know, when it rained that much the most rain, I think, was 1854 in San Diego. It was like something like 3.7 inches. But, you know, it's like, oh, well, just, you know, we know where it floods. It flooded the same places it did this time as it did a couple decades ago or last El Nino. And so maybe build some more infrastructure in that area. But now it's just throw your hands up and say, oh, you know, what can we do?
Let's sue an oil company.
That's right. That's right. Let's bring a lawsuit against an oil company, because this is surely out of our hands. We couldn't actually build more drainage in the places that we know will flood. That would be, you know, ridiculous. Let's just throw our hands up and sue.
Well, Matt, thanks for your work. It's been good speaking with you today. I expect we'll speak again in the future. In the meantime, I want to thank you for coming on the show on behalf of myself and our listeners.
Thank you. Thanks, Darren.
Listeners, thanks for checking in on us today. Please check Heartland's website as we continue to follow the work of scientist Dr. Matthew Wilecki. Also, continue to follow us as we track the progress of energy and environmental laws and regulations that affect you. In addition, if you're not already receiving these podcasts on your favorite device, go to iTunes and subscribe. And when you have the time, please rate our podcast on iTunes so you can help us expand the reach of free market ideas. You might also check our weekly Climate Change Roundtable, soon to be renamed Climate Realism, the Climate Realism Show. It's on every Friday on your favorite social media streaming services, where Anthony Watts, Linnea Lucan, myself, and almost weekly guests discuss the climate topic of the week, complete with taking questions from viewers. Thanks. Take care. Bye.